Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Leif Enger, who reads from and discusses his new book, So Brave, Young, and Handsome, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. In the weeks to come, we have Simon Winchester and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting independent bookselling. Leif Enger holds a special place in our literary history here in Denver. 4 years ago, his phenomenal novel, Peace Like a River, which was named one of the best books of 2001, was the inaugural choice for our all-city read, One Book, One Denver, a choice that was met with such overwhelming enthusiasm and support from the community. We are so thrilled to have him back at the Tattered Cover with this new novel, So Brave, Young, and Handsome, a novel the LA Times hails as, quote, a sharp and brainy redemption tale with all the twists and turns and thrills of a dime store Western. And speaking of dime store westerns, unbeknownst to many is the fact that Peace Like a River was not Leif's first book. Years ago, he and his older brother, Lynn, co-wrote a series of mystery novels featuring a retired baseball player. He thinks of that experience as a fabulous apprenticeship as, quote, nobody really read them and they didn't get much attention. Boy, have times changed for this writer. We've all been eagerly awaiting a new novel from Leif, and now our wait has been rewarded. For as the LA Times review says of Leif and his status with this new novel, he's, quote, laid claim to a musical, sometimes magical and deeply satisfying kind of storytelling. I think you'll all agree. Please give a warm welcome to Leif Enger.
Thanks, Christine, and thanks to the Tattered Cover, one of those bookstores that no matter where you go, people know the name of the Tattered Cover. It's really pretty remarkable. And thanks to everybody here for coming out tonight. It's fun to see some familiar faces. Yeah, this is great. It's really fun to be back with another book. There were times when I wondered if it was going to happen, but here it is. And the truth is, I've wanted to write this sort of book for kind of a long time. I wanted to write an adventure story set in the West since I was a little kid, listening to cowboy stories and watching Western movies on television and hearing the songs that that Mom and Dad would play for me before I went to sleep, which were more or less Western songs sung by the Norm Luboff Choir in 1955. So I think that for all these years, one thing I've wanted to do was write a tale that would reference, daring train robberies and romantic cowboys and tragedy and all those things that are the glories of boyhood in some ways. But maybe it's a good thing I waited a while to do it, because you know how when you have a goal for a long time during your life and then you reach a point where you're about to take it on and try to accomplish that goal, usually by the time you reach that, the thing itself has kind of changed on you. I think that's a common tale, common story. And what changed for me over the years was that alongside all those boyhood glories of the daring outlaws and the wild escapes and the freedom of the high plains, alongside all those dreams, I began to sort of get a hold of another set of mysteries or set of truths that, like the cowboy stuff, seemed to me too wonderful not to be true. And I'm talking about some ideas that it's hard to grasp until you're a little bit beyond boyhood, such as that sometimes you win by losing, such as that we are at our strongest when we confess our weaknesses, things like that. And so some of these new ideas, some of these ancient ideas, filtered into and became an overlay upon my version of the Western myth, Western mythology. So I guess without saying too much more, I will read some selections from this new book. And then, if you like, we can have a conversation and we can talk about storytelling and writing and reading. And maybe you can tell me some stories of your own. A book is really only as strong as its characters. And so I'll just introduce you to a couple of the main characters here. We have a former train robber, Glendon Hale, who is seeking redemption in the modern age. The book takes place in 1915. We have his nemesis, a former Pinkerton operative, once based here in Denver, named Charles Siringo. Some of you have probably heard about Charles Siringo. Any Siringo aficionados in the room? No? I'm kind of surprised. He was a real figure who infiltrated outlaw gangs, lived at Hole in the Wall, chased after Billy the Kid in the months before Billy was actually shot down by Patrick Garrett. He was a genuine guy and wrote wonderfully about himself in two different memoirs, one about being a cowboy and one about being a Pinkerton operative. So he is the other sort of antagonistic character in the book. There's a young boy, a boy of 16, Hood Roberts, who is in some ways the archetypal tragic cowboy. And there is the narrator, Monty Beckett, who is a failed writer, a man who is struggling to come to grips with his failure to follow up a successful novel some years earlier. The book opens with Monty, the narrator, sitting on his porch overlooking the Cannon River in Northfield, Minnesota. And he is struggling to come up with some pages. He's trying to finish a book, and he knows already that he's not going to be able to do it. And so as he's working with these pages early in the morning, he hears someone rowing upriver, and he sees an old boatman, a man with white hair, wearing a white shirt, rowing a white boat, and coming upriver, and this sort of vision to Monty looks like freedom. He's feeling a bit chained to his work, and he calls out to the old guy who's rowing past and makes the briefest sort of contact, and the old guy rows on by. Monty's disappointed not to get to talk to him, but he's got a son named Red Start who the next day makes contact with the old boatman and finds out that his name is Glendon and invites him to breakfast the very next day. And so this is the scene where the old boatman, Glendon, comes to visit for breakfast. Son Red Start, by the way, is the kind of kid with advanced knowledge. He already knows at the age of 11 that if you know someone's real name, you have power over them. The first thing Red Star did was lay claim on him. Yes, it was, "Sit by me, Glendon. Pass the rolls, Glendon. Tell about Mexico, Glendon." Both Susanna and I began to stop our imperious child, but the old fellow shook off these attempts and weathered Red Star with dogged grace. People ask, what was he like? Had I invented Glendon myself, I couldn't have introduced a more puzzling guest to our table. He was formal in the way of men grown apart, yet energy teemed behind his eyes, and in some ways he seemed a boy himself. He might laugh abruptly at one of Red Start's childish jokes. He was pleased by the simplest plays on language, and like a boy, he kept eating rolls as long as there were rolls to be eaten. To Susanna, he gave all possible deference, rising when she got up for more coffee or frosting, saying thank you in reverent tones and with averted eyes. These manners endeared him to Susanna straight away so that she looked round the table to make sure Red Start and I were noticing how a gentleman acts. He gave his story in bright shards. Raised in Michigan, he had traveled west to become a cowboy, a memory that still excited him. He had been twice up the Chisholm Trail with herds of steers. and sung to them and swum rivers in their midst and had a horse gored out from under him during a stampede. Once in the Montana Rockies, he had stumbled on a shady cleft where 50 hapless livestock had bunched up in a blizzard. The snow was still melting when Glendon found the place in July, and he beheld a shrunken, grimy snowfield with dozens of hooked tapers slanting up from it, the horns of steers growing rapidly into the sunshine, like Satan's idea of horticulture. Red Start says, "You built that boat of yours," I said, wanting to get him off cowboying. He had left home at 12. Already Red Start was realigning his own future. "Yes, I love a boat," Glendon said. No one made comment, and he seemed quite willing to leave it at that, but then he abruptly added, "My wife loved them, too. She believed they were alive in some ways." "Your wife?" Susanna inquired. "Yes, my Blue," Glendon said. "Aranda knows her name. That's blueberry in the Mexican tongue." "But you are alone now," said Susanna tenderly. "Yes, we've been apart more than 20 years. She has another man, I understand." Glendon looked suddenly as downhearted as if the estrangement had happened hours ago instead of decades. "Why, I'm sorry," said Susanna, and we fell into one of those spreading, defeated moments from which there is no right recovery. "Well, I'll be going. Thank you for breakfast," Glendon said. And this time he did not wait for Susanna to rise, but was up and gone, glimmering. Red Start scooted after him, and there we sat, Susanna and I, perplexed. "He's like Peter Pan," she whispered, which happened to be the stage play we had attended on our first heady trip to New York City. "Then I'd better go see him off," I replied, "lest he fly away with our son." I followed them to the river, not really trying to catch up, because Glendon appeared lighthearted again, away from the house and the breakfast table and Susanna. He walked with his hands in his pockets, our pug, Bert, rolling about his ankles, and he said something that made Red Start laugh and look at me over his shoulder. "Tell one more Western tale," said Red Start, as I came up with them at the dock. "Just one more, Glendon, before you go." Glendon thought a moment. Then with a quiet spark said, "I've been 4 different times on trains that got robbed, yet never lost a dime." Offering this tidbit as though it were a riddle. "You were a train detective," said Red Start. "You foiled the robberies." "Shan't tell you," said Glendon. "You were a Pinkerton man," Glendon laughed aloud, saying, "I'm telling you nothing." Red Start frowned, then said darkly, "Why, you've got to tell me if I say so. I know your name, remember?" "Nope," quoth the old sprite, raising his brows, "for you know me by first name only. Well, I have both of yours, Red Start Beckett." And stepping to his boat, he danced a short hornpipe of victory. Truly, Susanna had it right, for he was Peter Pan before my eyes, shifting, magnetic, a neat invitation to the curious and the lost and the needy. He twirled a line and was adrift, and we waved and shouted as he seized his oars, the captivating imp. How could I know he was indeed to take flight, and very soon, and that it would be I and not Red Start who went with him? So Monty falls into a delightful friendship with Glendon, his new friend. And as time goes by, he works less on his writing and more on boat building with Glendon Hale in Glendon's barn down the river. And one of the things he discovers, it's all right. A couple days ago, I was reading in a church, and my phone rang. I was deeply embarrassed. One of the things that Monty learns is how tortured Glendon is by his conscience over having left his wife 25 years before in Mexico. And it's not a big surprise to Monty when Glendon decides that he needs to take on a quest, and that is to go to Mexico to find his former wife and to apologize, to atone, to make things right if it's possible for him to do so. He's not going to win her back. He's going to say he is sorry. And he asks Monty if he'll accompany him, and Monty agrees to go. What Glendon doesn't tell Monty until matters come to kind of a head is the truth that you have already figured out, which is that he was not ever the Pinkerton detective. He was the robber. He was the train robber. That's why he never lost a dime in the deal. And so without describing how it happens, I will say that in this scene, Glendon and Monty are traveling together on the Lamb upstream in a rowboat, accompanied only by a big snapping turtle they have caught, with the idea that the snapper will make them a good meal at some point when they are hungry. We struck no town that night and laid up at dawn on a sandy shore under a cottonwood tree. The tree would have provided superior shade, but by noon the sky turned to funeral wool and November came hissing through the grass. There are people who predict the weather, but on the Great Plains these are a fragile and disappointed little group. Glendon opened his kit and threw me a knitted sweater and donned an oilskin himself. We dragged the boat to high ground and knocked a few dead limbs off the cottonwood. "Beckett, I'm hungry. Go kill the turtle." I must have looked blank. "Stick this branch in front of his nose. When he takes hold, pull him out of the boat. Pull his head out as far as you can and cut it off." He handed me his knife. "My hands are still pretty sore," I said, despising my faint heart. "I rode us all night. I guess you can kill an old turtle," he replied. His voice had a grouchy rasp I had not heard before. I returned to the John boat. The snapper appeared relaxed. Warily, I held out the stick, which he refused to notice. "He won't bite," I called out. "Tap his beak, that'll fetch him." I tapped away, but the turtle just blinked and drew his head into his cave. "He isn't coming out." Glendon came over and gave the snapper an admiring look. He said, "You've been reading our mail." To me, he added, "Good luck, Beckett." Then off he went and started digging an earthen pit under the tree. He had in mind to build a fire in the pit and drop in the turtle and roast him slowly in the shell, along with the squash. We had had nothing since the bread and molasses earlier. In this cold breeze, a roasted turtle sounded like Christmas dinner. I laid the tip of the stick against its beak and tried to pry it open, but nothing. You don't expect restraint from these beasts. You expect reflexive violence. Instead, the snapper refused to snap and, in fact, looked canny and patient. Soon enough, Glendon had the pit dug and a vigorous fire inside it. He came over to watch my futile coaxings. "You sound impatient. Look at his face." "He doesn't like your tone," Glendon said, amused. "If that was my toe instead of a stick, he wouldn't show such control," I complained. "Why don't we just put him in the fire and cook him alive? That's what they do with lobsters." But Glendon was displeased. "Cook him alive? Look at him. He's probably older than me. It would be impertinent." "Well, you kill him then. I tried, and he's not coming out." "Cook him alive. For shame, Beckett." This attitude of Glendon struck me as impractical and possibly priggish. We were hungry. It was cold. Nobody ever thought it was impertinent to steam a lobster. Climbing the riverbank, I walked out onto the meadow where an upstart wind whipped the grasses into confusion. I didn't look at the sky until a cold gust struck my face. Only then did I see the black storm front riding in from the west. It rolled forth in a toppling motion. Even over the wind, I could hear the sizzling noise of water striking earth. I turned and bolted, reaching the river with the first raindrops. They spanked the weeds, tore leaves off the cottonwood. Determined to cook something, Glendon had thrown the squash on the coals and covered the pit with dirt. Without a word between us, we turned the boat upside down and crawled under. The turtle was in there, too. And together, the three of us watched the rain turn to hail. It began as fingertips, but changed to knuckles and fists. Amid this deafening rumpus, the turtle decided to escape. Forward he plowed. The gunwale lifted against his ridged back. Hailstones thumped his mossy shell plates. I caught Glendon's eye as the snapper moved out into the storm. Neither of us tried to stop him. Luckily for the boat, it only hailed about 10 minutes. Not many vessels could have stood up to more than that. Some of those hailstones were as broad as my hand, and they fell in bunches. Peering out from under, all the land we could see turned white in a hurry. Even the river was lathered in the churn inflicted by that storm. The turtle left a dirty track through the ice as it shambled away, but that was quickly covered. When the hail ended, the rain resumed. A soothing noise after that unseemly pounding. I actually dozed a while. When I crept out later, the smaller hailstones had all melted and the large ones lay shrinking in their craters. Glendon sat under the cottonwood on the only dry patch in sight. Pale smoke drifted up from the mound where he had covered the fire. I could smell the squash cooking in the earth. My stomach lurched with desire. "Look here, Beckett," said my friend. Next to the mound, almost on top of it, lay the snapper. His feet were withdrawn, but his head was extended, and he looked curious and stately. "What's he still doing here?" "I guess he likes the warmth," Glendon replied. He took his knife and uncovered the two squash. They were ruddy from cooking and steamed when he pierced their skins. We still had a little butter, and Glendon produced the salt in a milk glass shaker. He said grace in an apologetic voice, given he had stolen the entire meal. My fingers shook while I ate, and my eyes watered, and it was a remarkable supper right down to the seeds and the ropey core. I even considered eating the rind, but noticed Glendon laying his rind on the earth in front of the turtle. Instantly its beak flashed out. It wasn't faster than sight, as people will say, but it was certainly quick as a flinch, and the report of that beak popping was impressive. In seconds our snapper bolted the squash rind, then retracted his head as if to contemplate its effects. "Goodness," Glendon said. We were both a little shaken. "What do you suppose he's thinking about in there?" "Fingers," I said. "I had the same theory," he replied. "Look at him. He's disenchanted. Well, go on and feed him that rind, Beckett. Let's see if he'll do it again." There's one more character I just want to read about a little bit, and that is Charlie Siringo, the former Pinkerton. Later in the book, Siringo ends up traveling with Monty in pursuit of Glendon Hale. And Siringo has given Monty a copy of his memoir about his days as an agent. And he has just discovered that Monty is also a writer. And so they are sitting around a campfire far out in the West, and Siringo wants to talk a little shop. Siringo said, "Did you read my book?" "No." "How come?" I didn't answer. My eyes were still open, and I could see sleep moving toward me like rain across the prairie. "How come, hey?" Honestly, I hadn't looked at his book because I hadn't the heart. It discouraged me to think of this reckless Siringo sitting down and dashing off his hundreds of pages while also being a cowboy detective and productive bounty hunter in Living Legend, while I might struggle a week to put down six sentences that mattered. I hadn't read his book because I was afraid it would be good. "You got it with you?" Siringo demanded. "No. Though I did, it was still in my pack." "That's all right. Here, I'll tell you a bit." And he proceeded to narrate for me the first chapter of his memoir, wherein he leaves home as a stripling to get work driving horses. It was a swift, involving tale, packed with ruffians and violent broncs and sweet-faced girls from the opening gun. And Siringo had it word for word and pause for pause like a man of the theater, even though he had written it all down some 20 years before. "Why, that's exceptional narrative," I admitted when he had finished. "Well, it's what happened, more or less. It's what should have happened anyway. That's all I do, just lay down events without floral arrangement." He leaned back, pleased with his recital. "What about you, Beckett? How do you work your stories?" "I'm not writing anymore," I said. "What's that mean? Is your eyesight failing?" "It means I can't do it anymore." "Can't do it? I'm no good anymore, that's all. It's not the end of anything except one short career. Now I'm tired. Good night, Siringo." He said, "How can you be good once and then not?" He seemed more awake than ever and also sincere in his puzzlement. Glancing at him, I saw a man watching me with something resembling concern. No onlooker would have guessed he had kidnapped me and put me in torment through much of the day. I shut my eyes and tried to drift. Siringo was stirring the coals. Abruptly, he said, "Say, Beckett, is your mind all right?" "It's fine." "Do you know your alphabet?" "Yes, I know the alphabet." "Sing it for me." "Sing it? You know, A, B, C, D." "I know it." Siringo threw something, a small rock, and hit me on the chest. I sang the little tune. "Well, you got the letters." He narrowed his eyes. "You own a dictionary?" both Oxford's and Webster's. You got every tool in the box, and you still can't make a story. Not a good one, it seems. Blessed silence while he thought this through. Then he chirruped hoarsely and issued a diagnosis. Why, poor Beckett. You got no medicine, that's what it is. You used it all up in only the one book. You got no medicine left at all. It put him in such a good mood that he let me go to sleep at last. Down I went like a spoiled prince, hard earth and neck bones and all. Whether Siringo slept, I don't know. When I awoke, he was crouched over the fire. It was just dawn, and his face was pale as smoke. It gave me hope. Clearly he was weak. In those cold first moments, the thought even came to me that Siringo was dying, that this would be his last day. It was followed, however, by the much worse thought that he had died already, during the night, and was up anyway, making coffee in the normal fashion, and that I would be compelled for some time to be the companion of a dead fellow who refused to acknowledge his condition. Well, does anybody have a discussion point, any questions or answers or unresolved anger issues?
Read about
Hood. Well, no, I didn't read about Hood.
Yes.
Were you hoping I would?
Yes.
Somebody who likes Hood. Well, I don't know. Do I have time to read a short section about Hood? Okay. I love Hood. Hood's one of my favorite people in this book. They come upon Hood Roberts in a little town called Revival in Kansas, and Hood is a mechanic. He's working on a car, a beat-up old Packard, that they end up buying because boats going upstream are just too slow. And so Hood promises them that he'll work all night to fix the Packard if they'll buy it, and then he'll go with them as far as the 101 Ranch in Ponca City, Oklahoma, where he wants to work. Hood Roberts had worked all night as promised. The Packard ran, though noisily, and I handed $35 to a sandy-haired man named Lewis who walked me around the car with its torn spokes and mauled fenders before handing me a bill of sale. Here's one of those moments a man remembers. Should you be considering the use of an alias? Let me advise you not to pass too much time in choosing it. Just reach in the old hat and pick one out rapidly. That's what I did. Jack Waits, I wrote with a salty flourish, and handed back the paper. "Traveling mercies, Mr. Waits," said the courteous Lewis, and we were on our way. Glendon, as mentioned, did not drive, so that part was up to me. Oh, yes, Hood could drive, but I rarely allowed it. He was too distractible. He might cruise along evenly 20 or 30 minutes, but say he observed something interesting off to the right. A Canada goose flaring into land, or an appealing horse throwing its mane about. Such spectacles made Hood forget about steering the Packard. And off the road we would drift into whatever pasture or plowed field or other lumpy piece of Kansas was at hand. We had some dire flights. After the first day, I just drove all the time. Hood sulked a little, but he couldn't stay blue for long. His spirits were just too high. "Did you see the way that farmer looked us over?" he'd ask. "Did you see that girl beating out the rugs? She wanted to come with us, I bet. She had a funny look." Everything looked funny to Hood in those early days. He talked and he laughed. He talked himself hoarse. He talked like a former mute, distrustful of the cure. He told how he had been to see the doctor, Burke, who had wrecked the car, and how Burke cut a prodigious wart off the thumb of his right hand. Hood spoke proudly of that wart. He said it was dark and fuzzy like a small mammal, a mouse, a vole. Once he forgot it and reached for a girl's hand, and she screamed and ran down the road. He told us this story our first night out, camped beside the riverbank. "Let's see the thumb now," said Glendon, and Hood held up his hand. There was a dishy place where the skin was glazed shellac. "It's a fine job," Glendon remarked. "Yes, he's a good doctor, but a sorry driver. This was the third car he spoiled in 2 years," Hood said, adding, "Doctors oughtn't be allowed to drive." It seemed fitting having the boy along. I was glad for his company, his lifted soul. He talked about the doctor, laughed about the wart. Later, curled by the little pile of coals, he laughed in his sleep. Glendon sometimes did that, too. In my whole life, I have known just two people to laugh in their sleep. On that short trip from Revival to the 101, I was kept awake by both of them. Thanks for coming out. It's a gorgeous evening in Denver, Colorado, and you guys could be doing so many other things. And it's really nice that you're here making me welcome. I appreciate it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for Simon Winchester and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on May 21st, 2008.